that the matter of the divine governing of Sumer could no longer be left open-ended, and the most suitable candidate for the task was Nannar, Sin. Throughout the turbulent times he was overshadowed by more aggressive contenders for the supremacy, including his own daughter, Inanna. Now he was finally given the opportunity to assume the status befitting him as the firstborn, on earth, of Enlil. The era that followed, let us call it the era of Nannar, was one of the most glorious in Sumerian annals. It was also Sumer's last hurrah. His first order of business was to make his city, Ur, a great metropolis and the capital of a vast empire, appointing a new line of rulers, known by scholars as the Third Dynasty of Ur. Nannar achieved for this capital and for Sumerian civilization unprecedented peaks of material and cultural advancements. From an immense ziggurat that dominated the walled city, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 90, a ziggurat whose crumbled remains, after more than 4,000 years, still rise awesomely from the Mesopotamian plain. Nannar and his spouse Ningal took an active part in the affairs of state. Attended by a hierarchy of priests and functionaries, headed by the king, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 91, they guided the city's agriculture to become the granary of Sumer, directed its sheep breeding to make Ur the wool and garment center of the ancient Near East, and developed a foreign trade by land and water that made the merchants of Ur remembered for millennia thereafter. To service this thriving trade and the far-flung links, as well as to improve the city's defenses, the city's surrounding wall was in turn surrounded by a navigable canal, serving two harbors, a west harbor and a north harbor, with an inner canal connecting the two harbors, and in turn separating the sacred precinct and the palace and administrative quarter from the residential and commercial parts of the city, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 92. It was a city whose white houses, many of them multi-storied, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 93, shined as a pearl from a distance, whose streets were straight and wide, with many a shrine at their intersections, a city of an industrious people with a smooth-functioning administration, a city of pious people, never failing to pray to their benevolent deities. The first ruler of the Third Dynasty of Ur, Ur-Nammu, the Joy of Ur, was no mere mortal. He was semi-divine, his mother being the goddess Ninsun. His extensive records state that as soon as Nannu and Enlil had turned over kingship to Nannar at Ur, and Ur-Nammu was selected to be the righteous shepherd of the people, the gods ordered Ur-Nammu to institute a new moral revival. The nearly three centuries that had passed since the moral revival under Uru-Kagina of Lagash witnessed the rise and fall of Akkad, the defying of the authority of Anu, and the defilement of Enlil's Iker. Injustice, oppression, and immorality had become the common behavior. At Ur, under Ur-Nammu, an attempt was launched once again by Enlil to steer mankind away from evil ways to a course of righteousness. Proclaiming a new code of justice and social behavior, Ur-Nammu established equity in the land, banished malediction, ended violence and strife. Expecting so much from this new beginning, Enlil, for the first time, entrusted the guardianship of Nippur to Nannar, and gave Ur-Nammu the necessary instructions for the restoration of the Iker, which was damaged by Naram-Sin. Ur-Nammu marked the occasion by erecting a stela, showing him carrying the tools and basket of a builder, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 94. When the work was completed, Enlil and Ninlil returned to Nippur to reside in their restored abode. Enlil and Ninlil were happy there, a Sumerian inscription stated. The return to righteous ways involved not only social justice among people, but also proper worship of the gods. To that effect, Ur-Nammu in addition to the great works in Ur, also restored and enlarged the edifices dedicated to Anu and Inanna at Erech, to Ninsun, his mother, at Ur, to Utu at Larsa, to Ninharsag at Adab. He also engaged in some repair work at Eridu, Enki's city. Conspicuously absent from the list are Ninurta's Lagash and Marduk's Babylon. The social reforms of Ur-Nammu and Ur's achievements in commerce and industry have led scholars to view the times of the Third Dynasty as a period not only of prosperity, but also of peace. They were thus puzzled to find in the ruins of Ur two panels depicting its citizens' activities, one a peace panel, and the other, surprisingly, a war panel, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 95. The image of the people of Ur as trained and ready warriors seemed totally out of place. Yet the facts, as told by the archaeological evidence of weaponry, military garb, and chariots of war, as well as in numerous inscriptions, belie the image of pacifism. Indeed, one of the first acts of Ur-Nammu was to subdue Lagash and slay its governor, then occupy seven other cities. The need for military measures was not limited to the initial phases of the ascendancy of Nannar and Ur. We know from inscriptions that after Ur and Sumer enjoyed days of prosperity and rejoiced greatly in Ur-Nammu, after Ur-Nammu then rebuilt the Eker in Nippur, and Lil found him worthy of holding the divine weapon. With it, Ur-Nammu was to subdue evil cities in foreign lands. The divine weapon, that which in the hostile lands heaps up the rebels in piles, to Ur-Nammu, the shepherd, he, the lord in Lil, has given it to him, like a bull to crush the foreign land, like a lion to hunt it down, to destroy the evil cities, clear them of opposition to the lofty. These are words reminiscent of biblical prophecies of divine wrath, through the medium of mortal kings against evil cities and sinful people. They reveal that beneath the cloak of prosperity there was lurking a renewed warfare among the gods, a struggle for the allegiance of the masses of mankind. The sad fact is that Ur-Nammu himself, becoming a mighty warrior, the might of Nannar, met a tragic death on the battlefield. The enemy land revolted, the enemy land acted hostily. In a battle in that unnamed but distant land, Ur-Nammu's chariot got stuck in the mud. Ur-Nammu fell off it. The chariot, like a storm, rushed along, leaving Ur-Nammu behind, abandoned on the battlefield like a crushed jug. The tragedy was compounded when the boat returning his body to Sumer, in an unknown place, had sunk. The waves sank it down, with him, Ur-Nammu, aboard. When the news reached Ur, a great lament went up there. The people could not understand how such a righteous shepherd, one who had been just for the people and true to the gods, could have met such a disgraceful end. They could not understand why the Lord Nannar did not hold him by the hand, why Inanna, Lady of Heaven, did not put her noble arm around his head, why the valiant Utu did not assist him. Why had these gods stepped aside when Ur-Nammu's bitter fate was determined? Surely it was a betrayal by the great gods. How the fate of the hero has been changed. Anu altered his holy word, and Lil, deceitfully, changed his fate decree. The manner in which Ur-Nammu had died may have accounted for the behavior of his successor, of whom one can use the biblical contempt for a king who prostituted himself and did that which was evil in the view of the Lord. Named Shulgi, he was born under divine auspices. It was Nannar himself who had arranged for the child to be conceived at Enlil's shrine in Nippur. Through a union between Ur-Nammu and Enlil's high priestess, so that a little Enlil, a child suitable for kingship and throne, shall be conceived. The new king began his long reign by choosing to keep together his far-flung empire through peaceful means and religious reconciliation. As soon as he ascended the throne, he embarked on the building, or rebuilding, of a temple for Ninurta in Nippur. This enabled him to declare Ur and Nippur to be brother cities. He then built a ship, naming it after Ninlil, and sailed to the land of flying for life. His poems indicate that he imagined himself a second Gilgamesh, following in that earlier king's footsteps to the land of living, to the Sinai Peninsula. Landing at the place of the ramp, or the landfill place, Shulgi built there an altar to Nannar. Continuing his journey on land, Shulgi reached the Harsag, Ninharsag's high mountain in the southern Sinai, and built there an altar too. Winding his way in the peninsula, he reached the land called Bad-gal-dingir, Dur-ma-ilu in Akkadian, the great fortified place of the gods. He now was indeed emulating Gilgamesh, for Gilgamesh, arriving from the direction of the Dead Sea, had also stopped to pray and make offerings to the gods at that gateway place, situated between the Negev and the Sinai proper. There, Shulgi built an altar to the god who judges. It was the 8th year of Shulgi's reign as he began the journey back to Sumer. His route, via the Fertile Crescent, began in Canaan and Lebanon, where he built altars at the place of bright oracles and the snow-covered place. It was a deliberately slow journey, intended to strengthen the imperial bonds with the distant provinces. It was as a result of this journey that Shulgi built a network of roads that held the empire together politically and militarily, and also enhanced trade and prosperity. Getting personally acquainted with the local chieftains, Shulgi further cemented his ties with them by arranging marriages for his daughters. Shulgi returned to Sumer, boasting that he had learned 4 foreign languages. His imperial prestige was at its peak. In gratitude, he built for Nannar-Sin a shrine in the sacred precinct of Nippur. In return, he was rewarded with the titles High Priest of Anu, Priest of Nannar. Shulgi recorded the 2 ceremonies on his cylinder seals, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figures 96 and 97. But as time went by, Shulgi increasingly preferred the luxuries of Ur to the rigors of the provinces, leaving their government to grand emissaries. He spent his time composing self-laudatory hymns, imagining himself a demigod. His delusions eventually caught the attention of the greatest seductress of all, Inanna. Sensing a new opportunity, she invited Shulgi to Erech, making him a man chosen for the vulva of Inanna, and engaging in lovemaking in the very temple dedicated to Anu. We quote Shulgi's own words, "With valiant Utu, a friend as a brother, I drank strong drink in the temple founded by Anu. My minstrels sang for me the 7 songs of love. Inanna, the queen, the vulva of heaven and earth, was by my side, banqueting in the temple." As the unavoidable restiveness at home and abroad grew, Shulgi sought military support from the southeastern province of Elam. Arranging for his daughter to marry Elam's viceroy, Shulgi gave him as dowry the city of Larsa. In return, the viceroy brought into Sumer Elamite troops to serve Shulgi as a foreign legion. But instead of peace, the Elamite troops brought more warfare, and the yearly records of Shulgi's reign speak of repeated destruction in the northern provinces. Shulgi attempted to retain his hold on the western provinces by peaceful means, and his 37th year of reign records a treaty with a local king named Puzur-ish-Dagon, a name with clear Canaanite Philistine connotations. The treaty enabled Shulgi to reclaim the title King of the 4 Regions, but the peace in the west did not last long. In his 41st year, Shulgi received certain oracles from Nannar-Sin, and a major military expedition was launched against the Canaanite provinces. Within 2 years, Shulgi could claim once more that he was Hero, King of Ur, ruler of the 4 Regions. The evidence suggests that Elamite troops were used in this campaign to subdue the provinces, and that these foreign troops had advanced as far as the gateway to the Sinai. Their commander called himself Favorite of the God Who Judges, beloved by Inanna, occupier of Dur-Ilu. But no sooner had the occupying troops withdrawn than the unrest began again. In the year 2049 B.C., Shulgi ordered the building of the Wall of the West to protect Mesopotamia. He stayed on the throne one more shaky year, although until the end of his reign, Shulgi continued to proclaim himself a cherished of Nannar. He was no longer a chosen of Anu and Enlil. In their recorded view, the divine regulations he did not carry out. His righteousness he dirtied. Therefore, they decreed for him the death of a sinner. The year was 2048 B.C. Shulgi's successor on the throne of Ur was his son, Amar-Sin. Though the first 2 years of his reign were recalled by their warfare, 3 years of peace did follow. But in the sixth year, an uprising needed subduing in the northern district of Asher. And in the seventh year, 2041 B.C., a major military campaign was required to suppress 4 western localities and their lands. The campaign, apparently, was not too successful, for it was not followed by the customary bestowal of titles on the king by Nannar. Instead, we find that Amar-Sin turned his attention to Eridu, Enki's city, establishing there a royal residence and assuming there priestly functions. This twist in religious filialties may have been prompted by the practical desire to gain control of Eridu's shipyards. For in the following ninth year, Amar-Sin set sail to the same place of the ramp where Shulgi had gone. But reaching the land of flying for life, he got no farther. He died of a scorpion's or snake's bite. He was replaced on the throne by his brother, Shusin. The 9 years of his reign, though recording 2 military forays against northern localities, were more conspicuous by their defensive measures. These included the strengthening of the Wall of the West against the Amorites, and the construction of 2 ships, the Great Ship and the Ship of the Abzu. It looks as though Shusin was preparing an escape by sea. When the next and last king of Ur, Ibi-Sin, ascended the throne. Raiders from the west were clashing with the Elamite mercenaries in Mesopotamia proper. Soon, Sumer's heartland was under siege. The people of Ur and Nippur were huddled behind protective walls, and the influence of Nannar had shrunk to a small enclave. Waiting in the wings, as once before, was Marduk. Believing that his time for supremacy had finally come, he left his land of exile and led his followers back to Babylon. And then awesome weapons were unleashed, and disaster, unlike any that befell mankind since the deluge, struck. Chapter 13. Abraham, the Fateful Years. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goam, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zebaim, with the king of Bela, which is Zoar. Thus begins the biblical tale of an ancient war that pitted an alliance of 4 kingdoms of the east against 5 kings in Canaan. It is a tale that has evoked some of the most intense debate among scholars, for it connects the story of Abraham, the first Hebrew patriarch, with a specific non-Hebrew event, and thus affords objective substantiation of the biblical record of the birth of a nation. How wonderful it would have been, many have felt, if the various kings could be identified, and the exact time of Abraham established. But even if Elam was known, and Shinar identified as Sumer, who were the kings named? And which were the other lands of the east? Questioning the authenticity of biblical history, unless independently verified, critics of the Bible asked, why don't we find the names Kedorlaomer, Amraphel, Arioch, and Tidal mentioned in Mesopotamia inscriptions? And if they did not exist, if such a war had not taken place, how credible is the rest of the tale of Abraham? For many decades, the critics of the Old Testament seemed to prevail. Then, as the 19th century was drawing to a close, the scholarly and religious worlds were astounded by the discovery of Babylonian tablets naming Kedorlaomer, Arioch, and Tidal in a tale not unlike the biblical one. The discovery was announced in a lecture by Theophilus Pinches to the Victoria Institute, London, in 1897. Having examined several tablets belonging to the Spartoli collection in the British Museum, he found that they described a war of wide-ranging magnitude in which a king of Elam named Kudur Lagomar led an alliance of rulers that included one called Ariaku and another named Tudgula, names that easily could have been transformed into Hebrew as Kedorlaomer, Arioch, and Tidal. Accompanying his published lecture with a painstaking transcript of the cuneiform writing and a translation thereof, Pinches could confidently claim that the biblical tale had indeed been supported by an independent Mesopotamian source. With justified excitement, the Assyriologists of that time agreed with Pinches' reading of the cuneiform names. The tablets indeed spoke of Kudur-Lagomar, king of the land of Elam, uncannily similar to the biblical Kedorlaomer, king of Elam. All scholars agreed that it was a perfect Elamite royal name, the prefix Kudur, servant, having been a component in the names of several Elamite kings, and Lagomar being the Elamite epithet name for a certain deity. It was agreed that the second name, spelled Eri-A-A-Ku in the Babylonian cuneiform script, stood for the original Sumerian Eri-Aku, meaning servant of the god Aku, Aku being a variant of the name of Nannar, Sin. It is known from a number of inscriptions that Elamite rulers of Larsa bore the name servant of Sin, and there was therefore little difficulty in agreeing that the biblical Elisar, the royal city of the king Arioch, was in fact Larsa. There was also unanimous agreement among the scholars for accepting that the Babylonian texts Tudgula was the equivalent of the biblical Tidal, king of Goam, and they agreed that by Goam, the book of Genesis referred to the nation hordes whom the cuneiform tablets listed as allies of Kedorlaomer. Here, then, was the missing proof, not only of the veracity of the Bible and of the existence of Abraham, but also of an international event in which he had been involved. But the excitement was not to last. Unfortunately, to use an expression of A.H. Sayce in an address to the Society of Biblical Archaeology 11 years later, a contemporary discovery, which should have upheld the one announced by Pinches, ended up sidetracking and even discrediting it. The second discovery was announced by Vincent Scheele, who reported that he had found among the tablets in the Imperial Ottoman Museum in Constantinople a letter from the well-known Babylonian king Hammurabi, which mentions the very same Kudur-Lagomar. Because the letter was addressed to a king of Larsa, Father Scheele concluded that the three were contemporaries, and thus matched three of the four biblical kings of the East, Hammurabi being none other than Amraphel, king of Shinar. For a while it seemed that all the pieces of the puzzle had fallen into place. One can still find textbooks and biblical commentaries explaining that Amraphel stands for Hammurabi. The resulting conclusion that Abraham was a contemporary of this ruler seemed plausible, but it was then believed that Hammurabi reigned from 2067 to 2025 BC, placing Abraham, the War of the Kings, and the ensuing destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah at the end of the 3rd millennium BC. However, when subsequent research convinced most scholars that Hammurabi reigned much later, the synchronization seemingly achieved by Scheele fell apart, and the whole bearing of the discovered inscriptions, even those reported by Pinches, came into doubt. Ignored were the pleas of Pinches that no matter with whom the three named kings were to be identified, that even if Kedorlaomer Arioch and Tidal of the cuneiform texts were not contemporaries of Hammurabi. The text's tale, with its three names, was still a remarkable historical coincidence and deserves recognition as such. In 1917, Alfred Jeremias attempted to revive interest in the subject, but the scholarly community preferred to treat the Spartoli tablets with benign neglect. They remained ignored in the basement of the British Museum for half a century, when M.C. Astor returned to the subject in a study at Brandeis University. Agreeing that the biblical and Babylonian editors of the respective texts drew from some older, common Mesopotamian source, he identified the four kings of the East as known rulers. One, of Babylon in the 8th century B.C., two, of Assyria in the 13th century B.C., three, of the Hittites in the 16th century B.C., and four, of Elam in the 12th century B.C. As none were contemporaries of each other or of Abraham, he ingeniously suggested that the text was not a historical one, but a work of religious philosophy, wherein the author used four diverse historic incidents to illustrate one moral, the fate of evil kings. The improbability of Astor's suggestion was soon pointed out in other scholarly publications, and with that, the interest in the Kedorla Omer texts died again. Yet the scholarly consensus that the biblical tale and the Babylonian texts drew on a much earlier common source impels us to revive the plea of Penchus and his central argument. How can cuneiform texts, affirming the biblical background of a major war and naming three of the biblical kings, be ignored? Should the evidence, crucial, as we shall show, to the understanding of fateful years, be discarded, simply because Amraphel was not Hammurabi? The answer is that the Hammurabi letter found by Scheel should not have sidetracked the discovery reported by Penchus, because Scheel misread the letter. According to his rendition, Hammurabi promised a reward to Sin-Adina, the king of Larsa, for his heroism on the day of Kedorla Omer. This implied that the two were allies in a war against Kedorla Omer, and thus contemporaries of that king of Elam. It was on this point that Scheel's find was discredited, for it contradicted both the biblical assertion that the three kings were allies and known historical facts. Hammurabi treated Larsa not as an ally, but as an adversary, boasting that he overthrew Larsa in battle and attacked its sacred precinct with the mighty weapon which the gods had given him. A close examination of the actual text of Hammurabi's letter reveals that in his eagerness to prove the Hammurabi-Amraphel identification, Father Scheel reversed the letter's meaning. Hammurabi was not offering as a reward to return certain goddesses to the sacred precinct, the Emutbal of Larsa. Rather, he was demanding their return to Babylon from Larsa. To Sin-Adina speaks thus Hammurabi regarding the goddesses who in Umutbal have been behind doors from the days of Kudur-Lagomar, in sackcloth attired. When they ask them back from thee, to my men hand them over. The men shall grasp the hands of the goddesses. To their abode they shall bring them. The incident of the abduction of the goddesses has thus occurred in earlier times. They were held captive in the Umutbal from the days of Kedorla Omer, and Hammurabi was now demanding their return to Babylon, from where Kedorla Omer had taken them captive. This can only mean that Kedorla Omer's days were long before Hammurabi's time. Supporting our reading of the Hammurabi letter found by Father Scheel in the Constantinople Museum is the fact that Hammurabi repeated the demand for the return of the goddesses to Babylon in yet another stiff message to Sin-Adina, this time sending it by the hand of high military officers. This second letter is in the British Museum, and its text was published by L. W. King in the Letters and Inscriptions of Hammurabi. Unto Sin-Adina, thus saith Hammurabi, I am now dispatching Zakir Elishu, the transport officer, and Hammurabi Bani, the front-line officer, that they may bring the goddesses who are in Umutbal. That the goddesses were to be returned from Larsa to Babylon is made clear in the letter's further instructions. Thou shalt cause the goddesses to journey in a processional boat as in a shrine, that they may come to Babylon. The temple women shall accompany them. For food of the goddesses, thou shalt load pure cream and cereals unto the boat. Sheep and provisions thou shalt put on board for the sustenance of the temple women, enough for the journey to reach Babylon. And thou shalt appoint men to tow the boat, and chosen soldiers to bring the goddesses to Babylon in safety. Delay them not. Let them speedily reach Babylon. It is thus clear from these letters that Hammurabi, a foe, not an ally of Larsa, was seeking restitution for events that had happened long before his time, in the days of Kudur-Lagomar, the Elamite regent of Larsa. The texts of the Hammurabi letters thus affirm the existence of Kedorlaomer and of Elamite reign in Larsa, Elasar, and thus of key elements in the biblical tale. Which is the period into which these key elements fit? As historical records have established, it was Shulgi who in the 28th year of his reign gave his daughter in marriage to an Elamite chieftain and granted him the city of Larsa as a dowry. In return, the Elamites put a foreign legion of Elamite troops at Shulgi's disposal. These troops were employed by Shulgi to subdue the western provinces, including Canaan. It is thus in the last years of Shulgi's reign, and when Ur was still an imperial capital under his immediate successor, Amar-Sin, that we find the historical time slot into which all the biblical and Mesopotamian records seem to fit perfectly. It is in that time, we believe, that the search for the historical Abraham should be conducted. For, as we shall show, the tale of Abraham was interwoven with the tale of the fall of Ur, and his days were the last days of Sumer. With the discrediting of the Amraphel Hammurabi notion, the verification of the age of Abraham became a free-for-all, some suggesting such late dates that made the first patriarch a descendant of the later kings of Israel. But the exact dates of his time and events need no guessing. The information is provided by the Bible itself. All we have to do is accept its veracity. The chronological calculations are surprisingly simple. Our starting point is 963 BC, the year in which Solomon is believed to have assumed the kingship in Jerusalem. The Book of Kings states unequivocally that Solomon began the construction of the Temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem in the fourth year of his reign, completing it late in the 11th year. 1 Kings chapter 6 verse 1 also states that it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, that he began to build the house of Yahweh. This statement is supported with a slight difference by the priestly tradition that there had been 12 priestly generations of 40 years each, from the Exodus to the time when Azariah executed the priestly office in the temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem. Both sources agree on the passage of 480 years, with this difference. One counts from the start of the temple's construction, and the other from its completion, when the priestly services could begin. This would set the Israelite exodus from Egypt in either 1440 or 1433 BC. The latter date, we find, offers better synchronization with other events. Based on the knowledge amassed by the beginning of this century, Egyptologists and biblical scholars had by then reached the conclusion that the Exodus had indeed taken place in the middle of the 15th century BC. But then the weight of scholarly opinion shifted to a 13th century date because it seemed to better fit the archaeological dating of various Canaanite sites, in line with the biblical record of the conquest of Canaan by the Israelites. Yet such a new dating was not unanimously agreed upon. The most notorious city conquered was Jericho, and one of its prominent excavators concluded that the pertinent destruction occurred circa 1560 BC, well ahead of the biblical events. On the other hand, Jericho's principal excavator, J. Garstang, held that the archaeological evidence points to its conquest sometime between 1400 and 1385 BC. Adding to this the 40 years of Israelite wandering in the wilderness after the departure from Egypt, he and others found archaeological support for an Exodus date sometime between 1440 and 1425 BC, a time frame that agrees with our suggestion of 1433 BC. For more than a century, scholars have also searched through the extant Egyptian records for an Egyptian clue to the Exodus and its date. The only apparent references are found in the writings of Manetho, as quoted by Josephus in Against Apion. Manetho stated that after the blasts of God's displeasure broke upon Egypt, a pharaoh named Tutmosis negotiated with the shepherd people, the people from the east, to evacuate Egypt and go whither they would, unmolested. They then left and traversed the wilderness and built a city in a country now called Judea and gave it the name Jerusalem. Did Josephus adjust the writings of Manetho to suit the biblical tale? Or did, in fact, the events concerning the sojourn, harsh treatment, and eventual exodus of the Israelites occur in the reign of one of the well-known pharaohs named Thothmes? Manetho referred to the king who expelled the pastoral people from Egypt in a section devoted to the pharaohs of the 18th dynasty. Egyptologists now accept as historical fact the expulsion of the Hyksos, the Asiatic shepherd kings, in 1567 BC by the founder of the 18th dynasty, the pharaoh Amosis, Amosis in Greek. This new dynasty, which established the new kingdom in Egypt, might well have been the new dynasty of pharaohs, who knew not Joseph, of which the Bible speaks. Theophilus, 2nd century bishop of Antioch, also referred in his writings to Manetho and stated that the Hebrews were enslaved by the king Thutmosis, for whom they built strong cities, Patho, and Ramses, and On, which is Heliopolis. Then they departed Egypt under the pharaoh, whose name was Amasis. It thus appears from these ancient sources that the Israelites' troubles began under a pharaoh named Thothmes, and culminated with their departure under a successor named Amasis. What are the historical facts as they have been established by now? After Amosis had expelled the Hyksos, his successors on the throne of Egypt, several of whom indeed bore the name Thothmes, as the ancient historians have stated, engaged in military campaigns in Greater Canaan, using the Way of the Sea as their invasion route. Thothmes I, a professional soldier, put Egypt on a war footing and launched military expeditions into Asia as far as the Euphrates River. It is our belief that it was he who feared Israelite disloyalty, "When a war shall be called, they shall join our enemies," and ordered therefore the killing of all newborn Israelite male babies. By our calculations, Moses was born in 1513 B.C., the year before the death of Thothmes I. J.W. Jack and others, earlier this century, had wondered whether the pharaoh's daughter, who had retrieved the baby Moses from the river and then raised him in the royal palace, could have been Hatshepsut, the eldest daughter of Thothmes I, by his official spouse, and thus the only royal princess of the time granted the high title, the king's daughter, a title identical to that given in the Bible. We believe that indeed it was she, and her continued treatment of Moses as an adopted son can be explained by the fact that after she had married the succeeding pharaoh, her half-brother Thothmes II, she could not bear him a son. Thothmes II died after a short reign. His successor, Thothmes III, mothered by a harem girl, was Egypt's greatest warrior king, an ancient Napoleon in the view of some scholars. Of his 17 campaigns against foreign lands to obtain tribute and captives for his major construction works, most were thrust into Canaan and Lebanon, and as far north as the Euphrates River. We believe, as T.E. Peet and others held earlier this century, that it was this pharaoh, Thothmes III, who was the enslaver of the Israelites, for in his military expeditions he pushed northward as far as Naharan, the Egyptian name for the area on the upper Euphrates called in the Bible Aram-Naharam, where the kinfolk of the Hebrew patriarchs had remained, and this could well explain the Pharaoh's fear that when there shall happen to be a war, they, the Israelites, shall join unto our enemies. It was, we suggest, Thothmes III, from whose death sentence Moses escaped to the wilderness of the Sinai, after he had learned of his Hebrew origins and openly sided with his people. Thothmes III died in 1450 B.C. and was followed on the throne by Amenophis II, the Amasis named by Theophilus, quoting Manetho. It was indeed after a long time that the king of Egypt died, that Moses dared return to Egypt to demand of the successor, Amenophis II, in our opinion, to let my people go. The reign of Amenophis II lasted from 1450 to 1425 B.C. It is our conclusion that the Exodus had taken place in 1433 B.C., exactly when Moses was 80 years old. Continuing our calculation backward, we now seek to establish the date when the Israelites arrived in Egypt. Hebrew traditions assert a stay of 400 years, in accord with the Lord's statement to Abraham. So also states the New Testament. The book of Exodus, however, says that the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. The qualifying of sojourn by the words who dwelt in Egypt might have been intended to distinguish between the Josephites, who had dwelt in Egypt, and the newly arrived families of Joseph's brothers, who just came to sojourn. If so, then the difference of 30 years can be accounted for by the fact that Joseph was 30 years old when made chief of Egypt. This would leave intact the 400 figure as the years of Israelite, rather than Josephite, sojourn in Egypt, and place the event in 1833 B.C. The next clue is found in Genesis, chapter 47, verses 8 through 9. And Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood him before the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh said unto Jacob, How old art thou? And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, The days of my years are 130. Jacob then was born in 1963 B.C. Now Isaac was 60 years old when Jacob was born unto him, and Isaac was born unto his father Abraham when Abraham was 100 years old. Accordingly, Abraham, who lived to be 175, was 160 years old when his grandson Jacob was born. This places the birth of Abraham in 2123 B.C. The century of Abraham, the 100 years from his birth to the birth of his son and successor Isaac, was thus the century that witnessed the rise and fall of the third dynasty of Ur. Our reading of biblical chronology and tales puts Abraham right in the middle of the momentous events of that time, not as a mere observer, but as an active participant. Contrary to the assertions of advocates of biblical criticism that with the tale of Abraham, the Bible loses interest in the general history of mankind and the Near East to focus on the tribal history of one particular nation, the Bible in fact continues to relate, as it did with the tales of the deluge and the Tower of Babel, events of major concern to mankind and its civilization, a war of unprecedented aspects, and a disaster of a unique nature, events in which the Hebrew patriarch played an important role. It is the tale of how the legacy of Sumer was salvaged when Sumer itself was doomed. In spite of numerous studies concerning Abraham, the fact remains that all we really know about him is what we find in the Bible, belonging to a family that traced its ancestry to the line of Shem. Abraham, then called Abram, was the son of Terah, his brothers being Haran and Nahor. When Haran died at an early age, the family was living in Ur of the Chaldees. There Abram married Sarai, later renamed Sarah. Then did Terah take Abram his son and Lot his grandson, the son of Haran, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, the wife of Abram his son, and they left and went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan, and then went as far as Haran and dwelt there. Archaeologists have found Haran, the caravanserai, situated to the northwest of Mesopotamia at the foothills of the Taurus Mountains, it was a major crossroads in antiquity. As Mari controlled the southern gateway from Mesopotamia to the lands of the Mediterranean coast, so did Haran control the gateway of the northern route to the lands of Western Asia, marking at the time of the Third Dynasty of Ur the limits of Nannar's domains where they bordered on Adad's Asia Minor. Haran was found by the archaeologists to have been a mirror image of Ur in its layout and in its worship of Nannar, Sin. No explanation is given in the Bible for leaving Ur, and there is also no time stated. But we can guess the answers if we relate the departure to events in Mesopotamia in general, and in Ur in particular. We know that Abraham was 75 when he proceeded later on from Haran to Canaan. The tenor of the biblical narrative suggests a long stay at Haran and depicts Abraham on his arrival there as a young man with a new bride. If Abraham, as we have concluded, was born in 2123 BC, he was a child of 10 when Ur-Nammu ascended the throne in Ur. When Nannar was favored for the first time with the trusteeship over Nippur. And he was a young man of 27 when Ur-Nammu inexplicably fell from Anu's and Enlil's favor, slain on a distant battlefield. We have described the traumatic effect of the event on the people of Mesopotamia, the shock it had given to their faith in Nannar's omnipotence, and the fidelity of Enlil's word. The year of Ur-Nammu's fall was 2096 BC. Could it not have been the year when, under the impact of the event, or as a consequence thereof, Terah and his family left Ur for a faraway destination, stopping off at Haran, the Ur away from Ur? All through the following years of Ur's decline and Shulgi's profanities, the family stayed on in Haran. Then, suddenly, the Lord acted again. And Yahweh said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and out of thy birthplace, and from thy father's house, unto the land which I will show thee. And Abram departed as Yahweh had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Once again, no reason is given for the crucial move, but the chronological clue is most revealing. When Abraham was 75 years old, the year was 2048 B.C., the very year of Shulgi's downfall. Because Abraham's family directly continued the line of Shem, Abraham has been considered a Semite, one whose background, cultural heritage, and language were Semitic, as distinct in scholars' minds from the non-Semitic Sumerians and the later Indo-Europeans. But in the original biblical sense, all the peoples of Greater Mesopotamia were descended of Shem, Semite and Sumerian alike. There is nothing in the Bible that suggests, as some scholars have begun to hold, that Abraham and his family were Amorites, i.e. Western Semites, who had come as immigrants to Sumer and then returned to their original abode. On the contrary, there is everything to support the image of a family rooted in Sumer from its earliest beginnings, hastily uprooted from its country and birthplace, and told to go to an unfamiliar land. The correspondence between two biblical events with the dates of two major Sumerian events, and of more to come, must serve as an indication of a direct connection between them all. Abraham emerges not as the son of immigrant aliens, but as the scion of a family directly involved in Sumerian affairs of state. In their search for the answer to the question of who was Abraham, scholars have seized upon the similarity between his designation as a Hebrew, Ibri, and the term Hapiru, which in the Near East could transform to Habiru, by which the Assyrians and Babylonians in the 18th and 17th centuries B.C., called bands of pillaging Western Semites. At the end of the 15th century B.C., the commander of an Egyptian garrison in Jerusalem asked his king for reinforcements against approaching Hapiru. Scholars have taken all that as evidence for the notion that Abraham was a Western Semite. Many scholars doubt, however, whether the term denotes an ethnic group at all, wondering whether the word was not a descriptive noun, simply meaning marauders or invaders. The suggestion that Ibri, clearly from the verb to cross, and Hipiru are one and the same entails substantial philological and etymological problems. There are also great chronological inconsistencies, all of which gave rise to serious objections to this suggested solution for the identity of Abraham, especially when the biblical data is compared with the bandit connotation of the term Hapiru. Thus, the Bible relates incidents concerning water wells, which show that Abraham was careful to avoid conflict with local residents as he journeyed through Canaan. When Abraham became involved in the War of the Kings, he refused to share in the booty. This is not the behavior of a marauding barbarian, but rather of a person of high standards of conduct. Coming to Egypt, Abraham and Sarah were taken to the Pharaoh's court. In Canaan, Abraham made treaties with the local rulers. This is not the image of a nomad pillaging other settlements. It is the image of a personage of high standing, skilled in negotiation and diplomacy. It was out of such considerations that Alfred Jeremias, then a leading Assyriologist and professor of the history of religion at the Leipzig University, announced in the 1930 edition of his masterwork, Das Alte Testament im Lichte des Alten Orients, that in his intellectual makeup Abraham was a Sumerian. He enlarged on this conclusion in a 1932 study entitled Der Kosmos von Sumer. Abraham was not a Semitic Babylonian, but a Sumerian. Abraham, he suggested, headed the faithful whose reformation sought to raise Sumerian society to higher religious levels. These were audacious ideas in a Germany witnessing the rise of Nazism with its racial theories. Soon after the assumption of power by Hitler, the heretic suggestions of Jeremias were strongly put down by Nicholas Schneider in a reply entitled War Abraham Sumerer. Abraham was neither a Sumerian nor a man of pure descent, he concluded. From the time of the reign of the Akkadian king Sargon in Ur, the home place of Abraham, there was never there a pure, unmixed Sumerian population and a homogeneous Sumerian culture. The ensuing upheavals and World War II cut off further debate on the subject. Regrettably, the thread discerned by Jeremias has not been picked up. Yet all the biblical and Mesopotamian evidence tells us that Abraham was indeed a Sumerian. The Old Testament, in fact, provides us with the time and manner in which Abraham was transformed from a Sumerian nobleman to a West Semitic potentate, under a covenant between him and his God. Amid a ritual of circumcision, his Sumerian name, Abram, father's beloved, was changed to the Akkadian Semitic, Abraham, father of a multitude of nations, and that of his wife, Sarai, princess, was adapted to the Semitic, Sarah. It was only when he was 99 years old that Abraham became a Semite. As we decipher the age-old enigma of Abraham's identity and his mission to Canaan, it is in Sumerian history, customs, and language that we shall search for the answers. Is it not naive to assume that for the mission to Canaan, for the birth of a nation, and for kingship over all the lands from the border of Egypt to the border of Mesopotamia, the Lord would choose someone at random, picking up anyone in the streets of Ur? The young woman whom Abraham married bore the epithet name Princess. Since she was a half-sister of Abraham, indeed she is my sister, the daughter of my father but not the daughter of my mother, we can take it for granted that either Abraham's father or Sarah's mother was of royal descent. Since the daughter of Haran, Abraham's brother, also bore a royal name, Milcah, queenly, it follows that it was through the father of Abraham that the royal ancestry flowed. In dealing with Abraham's family, we thus deal with a family of Sumer's highest echelons, people of a noble deportment and elegant dress, as found depicted on various Sumerian statues, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 98. It was a family that not only could claim descent from Shem, but which kept family records tracing its lineage through generations of firstborn sons. Arpakshad, and Shelek, and Eber, Peleg, Reu, and Serug, Nahor, and Terah, and Abraham, taking the family's recorded history back for no less than 3 centuries. What do the epithet names signify? If Shelach, sword, was born 258 years before Abraham, he was born in 2381 B.C. That indeed was the time of the strife that brought Sargon to the throne in the new capital, Agada, united, symbolizing the unification of the lands and a new era. 64 years later, the family named its firstborn descendant Peleg, division, for in his days the land divided. It was the time, in fact, when Sumer and Akkad were torn apart after Sargon's attempt to remove the sacred soil from Babylon and his consequent death. But of greatest interest to this very day has been the meaning of the name Eber, and the reason for bestowing it upon the firstborn in 2351 B.C., and from which has stemmed the biblical term Ebri, Hebrew, by which Abraham and his family identified themselves. It clearly stems from the root word meaning to cross, and the best scholars had to offer an explanation was to seek the Hebrew-Hapiru connection, which we have already mentioned and discarded. This erroneous interpretation has stemmed from the search for the meaning of the epithet name in Western Asia. It is our conviction that instead the answer is to be found in the Sumerian origins and the Sumerian language of Abraham and his ancestors. Such a look at the Sumerian roots of the family and the name provides an answer that startles with its simplicity. The term Ebri, Hebrew, by which Abraham and his family identified themselves, clearly stemmed from Eber, the father of Peleg, and from the root to cross. Instead of seeking the meaning of the epithet name in the Hapiru notions, or in Western Asia, it is our conviction that the answer is to be found in the Sumerian origins and the Sumerian language of Abraham and his ancestors. Then a new solution emerges with startling simplicity. The biblical suffix I, when applied to a person, meant a native of. Gileadi meant a native of Gilead, and so on. Likewise, Ebri meant a native of the place called Crossing, and that precisely was the Sumerian name for Nippur, Nib-Ru, the crossing place, the place where the pre-diluvian grids crisscrossed each other, the original navel of the earth, the old mission control center. The dropping of the N in transposing from Sumerian to Akkadian Hebrew was a frequent occurrence. In stating that Abraham was an Ebri, the Bible simply meant that Abraham was a Nibiri, a man of Nippurian origin. The fact that Abraham's family migrated to Haran from Ur has been taken by scholars to imply that Ur was also Abraham's birthplace. But that is not stated anywhere in the Bible. On the contrary, the command to Abraham to go to Canaan and leave for good his past abodes lists 3 separate entities, his father's house, which was then in Haran, his land, the city-state of Ur, and his birthplace, which the Bible does not identify. Our suggestion that Ebri means a native of Nippur solves the problem of Abraham's true birthplace. As the name Eber indicates, it was in his time, the middle of the 24th century B.C., that the family's association with Nippur had begun. Nippur was never a royal capital. Rather, it was a consecrated city, Sumer's religious center, as scholars put it. It was also the place where the knowledge of astronomy was entrusted to the high priests, and thus the place where the calendar, the relationship between the sun, earth, and moon in their orbits, was originated. Scholars have recognized that our present-day calendars derive from the original Nepurian calendar. All the evidence shows that the Nepurian calendar began circa 4000 BC, in the age of Taurus. In this, we find yet another confirmation of the umbilical cord connecting the Hebrew